Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It is Thorn in the Side Thursday here on the Horn, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. I'm Bob Kincaid, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the Horn, the home of conversation radio for nearly 7 years. 7 years in October. October the 24th will be our 7th anniversary. Here it is, the 20th day of September. You know, yesterday was the 20th day of September in Australia. And I want to thank, again, I want to thank our good friend Robert for posting that challenge yesterday that got us ever so near to being done with fundraising for the month of September. Because you met the challenge, and it's just amazing. Here, it's conceivable that in the next couple of days we could be finished with fundraising for the month of September, and I could say not another word about it, and you would beat the Swede 2 months in a row. And it's a beating the Swede likes. I mean, not that he's into that kind of thing or anything, but you know, he's the one, Scott's the one who put it out there. So we are within very close striking distance of beating the Swede. And, you know, I don't know when the last time was that I was able to do a week's worth of shows without mentioning fundraising. Wouldn't that just be cool? Or, depending on your feeling about it, we could try to get a jump on... Oh, shut up, Bob. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. And I gotta tell you, I go over a lot of stuff in the process of trying to pull a show together on any given night. And usually toward the end of the program, toward the end of the day, before airtime, there's a giggle or two along. I can't resist a funny. And for reasons that escape me, one of the funniest phenomena in recent cultural memory is this thing that happened with the, and it is a brilliant film if you've never seen it. Just great acting, brilliant portrayals. The film about the last days of Hitler called Downfall. I can't remember what the German word for it is. I haven't gotten to it on my Rosetta Stone yet. So far, I'm still learning how to buy a lilac necktie for my mother or something. You know, they want you to do things like that. But it's called Downfall, and one of the funniest things in recent cultural phenomena, is this practice of taking the section where Hitler finds out that everything has gone to perdition, and inserting subtitles. Oh, you know, Hitler finds out Michael Jackson is dead. Hitler finds out Tiger Woods had an affair. Well, I was scrolling down through Crooks and Liars a little bit ago, and this is absolutely useless for radio because it's video and you have to be able to read the subtitles. Oh, but God, this is good. You have to scroll down. That was posted at 5:30 this morning. Hitler finds out about Romney's secret video. The subtitle that I stopped on when I started the show. Was it Hitler screaming of Romney, he can't speak to another human being without being a dick. Oh, God, when Hitler's calling you a dick, you know you're really a dick. No, I'm not going to work blue tonight or anything. Whoever came up with it. And it's also a skewer to Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin. I mean, I don't want you to leave the program or anything, but go find it and watch it after. The other great one. Oh, let's see. Where is it? Might as well release his effing tax returns now. Might as well. Well, why not? How could it hurt him more than this stuff already has? Even if he deducted $450,000 a year to have some male escort wash his balls, it couldn't hurt him anymore. Who cares if he didn't pay any taxes? If it wasn't for the smirk on Harry Reid's face, I'd tell him to release his taxes right now, tonight. And then the woman who walks up to Ava Brown and says, because Ava Brown's crying, and she walks up to Ava Brown and says, he's exaggerating. Mitt doesn't have a ball washer. When I got to that part, I shot iced tea out my nose. It's worth your time. Because it is a fine, fine giggle. No, Jim, the film is not funny. It's this cultural phenomenon that took place. That scene in the bunker where everything's coming apart, and everything from Tiger Woods, Hitler finds out Michael Jackson is dead is probably the most famous one. But Hitler finds out that Tiger Woods had an affair. Hitler finds out that, I mean, you could just go to YouTube and type in Hitler finds out. There has been some real creativity applied to that scene. Brutal business. But merciful heaven. I don't know if subtitles have ever been funnier in any circumstance, and this in particular. You'll just have to, in order to get it, you'll just have to go and see it or any of the others. But yeah, you get it. Hey, I'm sorry. I started the program giggling, and I wanted you to know why. Some other good news, sincerely good news this evening. We have gotten our, 24th, 25th, 26th, and 27th sponsors of the AIC Act. Found out about them today. We're making progress. AICACT.org is where you can go to find out anything that you need to know about helping to end the Appalachian apocalypse and helping to make it more likely that future generations of Appalachian children will be able to breathe without ingesting toxic poisons, AICACT.org. And I will repeat what I said last night. If you are in Jackie Spears' district in California, her office, either in D.C. or her local offices, need a phone call from you. They need an email from you to let her know that you want her on the bill. We need the same in New Jersey. If you should happen to be in Frank Pallone's district, whatever congressional district you are in, however, it's always a good thing to call and say, "I want Congressman so and so or Congresswoman so and so to sign on to the AIC Act," because you will be taking a positive step forward in helping reclaim the rights as Americans that have so long been deprived or have so long been of which, here we go, there's the language, of which Appalachian people have been so long deprived. There we go. And who knows, we may have more sign on in the coming days, and I will try to let you know whenever that does happen. AICACT.org. Our buddy Philip writing in this evening, of course, last night he gave us the wonderful Willard of Oz. That's still engendering chuckles. Philip noting this evening, one of Willard's, Bishop Willard's supporters and fellow reactionary Republicans in Pennsylvania, okay, Philip says Republicans, I say Republicans, in Pennsylvania, stating publicly he is correct while failing at concealing his desire to obstruct the vote so they can obtain and retain it all. How sad George Orwell would be to learn that the effort to the political effort to corrupt the language and conceal intent through circumlocutions, euphemisms, and other such turns of language has deteriorated to merely expressing one's biases and stupidity openly. Philip says, I've seen this movie before, except that the Senate candidate and presidential aspirant in my and your neighboring state said, macaca, not 47%. You remember George Allen and macaca. These folks' desire for political power reveals that they aren't adverse to large government as long as it employs them and fulfills their agenda to the exclusion of the hopes and wishes of the majority of Americans. After all, Ronald Reagan increased the number of federal employees during his regime. He simply reappointed them or reapportioned them to the Department of Defense and other favorites at the expense of social programs. Very true, very true. Ron and Raleigh, with an early observation for the beginning of the program, who apparently did not just get in and therefore did not have to ask, what did I miss? He may have to go out later. He'll ask that later. Yeah. Ron and Raleigh said, while I was out and about earlier, I was listening to National Pentagon Radio. A report came on about a market protest in India. The newly burgeoning Indian middle class is pressuring the government to lift their ban on large foreign retailers. The newly flush are clamoring to allow Walmart to open. These folks are about to shoot themselves in the foot and don't have a clue. The large retail mom-and-pop culture will be destroyed if this happens, and the subsequent fallout in the remainder of the society will be devastating. The exploited lower classes will be even more exploited under the Walmart whip. Can you imagine what the pay rate will be for an untouchable stocker in the Mumbai Wally World? Makes me shudder to think, Ron says. Another story I heard is that the government of Myanmar is asking to have our sanctions dropped, ostensibly because having released Aung San Suu Kyi from detention, they're good guys now. Imagine dropping sanctions against these murderous swine while ramping up sanctions against Iran and keeping in place the ridiculous sanctions against Cuba. We are, says Ron, through the looking glass. Yeah, all the way through. Not even a sock sticking out the right end. Mm-mm. No. Well, if you're new to the program, I think you've got an idea of how conversation radio works. I mean, it's a constant stream of communication during show hours and outside show hours. Emails back and forth all day long. And you're welcome to chime in as well. Of course, the horn is live, and I say this for the folks who hear the show, perhaps, for instance, after the rerun after Malloy, Mike Malloy goes off. The show is live from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And you'll have to do the math for Central and Mountain. Not that hard. If I can do it, anybody can. But you're welcome. You're welcome to chime in with your thoughts, your ideas, your emails. I get emails about previous shows 2-3 days, sometimes a couple of weeks after a program has aired, and that's cool. It helps me remember what went on any given night, evening. Of course, the horn can be heard on a variety of platforms: Tuner, Internet Radio, TuneIn Radio, where apparently the horn is quite popular, which is very cool. TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, and the podcasts are available at WhiteRoseSociety.org and iTunes. You can also get access to the Horn stream directly from HeadOnRadioNetwork.com via the Listen Live button, and the link is also present at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Oh, yummy. Jug of Punch in the chat room just noted they've canned 18.5 quarts of sauerkraut from the crock today. Man, there ain't nothing better than fresh sauerkraut. Hoo-wee! Get out the brats. Along with a little mustard, you know, the good stuff. Not that just yellow, boring, no, the good stuff. But it is. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday here on the Horn. And thank you for the kind contribution that just rolled in. That is much appreciated. Like I said, we are getting very, very close. Let me take a quick look here. Because as I mentioned before, the bar graph is off by about $320. We are actually at $2351. $2351 is what we have raised for the month of September out of the $2,500 that we try to raise. That means, good gracious, $149 gets us done for the month of September. Amazing. That's mind-boggling. And it's also very important because we have reached a place in the Horn's evolution where if we don't meet the monthly fundraising goal, we're toast. So, it's just worth bearing in mind. And if we get that $149, then we beat the Swede, and it becomes $249. How can you argue with that? Now, on to the program. I mean, it's been the program already, but you know, Willard stepped in it again, right? Last night he went on Univision to appeal to the Latino vote. Sometimes I guess the universe just likes acts of futility. Univision, because you know Willard said, "Yeah, it'd be much easier. This would all be much easier if I was a little bit if I looked like a Mexican." Because you know that Bishop Willard Romney's daddy was brought across the border much like a modern-day Dream Act child is. Of course, the Republican Party despises both undocumented immigrants and their children. But I found this fascinating. The reason Univision wound up having to host its own presidential forum is because the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is a private, nonprofit group that gatekeeps the presidential debates, decided that there wouldn't be any there wouldn't be any moderators whose names ended in vowels. The story I'm looking at from National Pentagon Radio, National Petroleum Radio, notes that Univision wrote to the Commission on Presidential Debates asking them, pretty please, could someone of Hispanic or Latino origin be included as one of the moderators, seeing as how there are lots of Hispanic and Latino Americans. The Commission on Presidential Debates said no. Jorge Ramos is a network anchor at Univision. He said, it's so interesting because the Commission on Presidential Debates seems to believe that it's okay to have an African-American president, but it's not okay to have a moderator from a minority group. Janet Brown, the executive director of the Commission on Presidential Debates, said, we strongly believe that the four journalists we have named see their assignment as representing all Americans. Mr. Ramos, you know, I'll join you. I call BS on that. Because, I mean, the moderators for the presidential debates, I mean, you know, they come from the, it is a given that they have to come from the for-profit media. But it's not just anybody from the for-profit media. The closest you get to anything even remotely centrist is Jim Lehrer. Then you get Martha Raddatz for the vice presidential debate. And, the second presidential debate in a town hall format from Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, will be Candy Crowley, who, as our friend Jim points out, should never wear white before Labor Day. She's the chief political correspondent for CNN. And then, of course, old Bush administration pal Bob Schieffer, just slightly younger than Methuselah, will moderate the final presidential debate on Monday, October 22nd from Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida. Bob Schieffer, Candy Crowley, Martha Raddatz, and Jim Lehrer. Let's see, that's two guys and two girls, boy, girl, boy, girl. Only it works out in the schedule as boy, girl, girl, boy. You know, the guy always has to have the last word. But no, no one whose name ends in a vowel. So that forced Univision into the position of trying of hosting their own forum. Naturally, of course, the Commission on Presidential Debates has a monopoly on the debates. And, of course, all the questions are pre-screened. And, well, you know how I feel about debates. It's not going to be a debate. Not a debate within the meaning of the word that you might have learned in high school or college where you participated in the debating society or the debating team or the debate club or studied forensics in some speech class. These are not debates. These are pageants. Governor Romney, if you were a twee, what kind of twee would you be? You know, that kind of stuff. Senator, boxers or briefs? I mean, boxers or briefs, that's a real question that was answered and asked during a presidential debate during the 2008 go-round of the primaries. Boxers or briefs? Jesus. So Univision had their own forum. And last night, Bishop Willard Romney showed up for his half of the forum. I guess, what, tonight or tomorrow night will be President Obama's turn. And, you know, I mentioned that Hitler finds out about the secret Romney. Yeah. And what it... He can't help it. I mean, I was in Atlanta in 1988 when the brilliant Ann Richards declared to the assembled faithful of the Democratic National Convention that year that they nominated Michael Dukakis to run against George H.W. Bush. Boggles the mind. It was a great convention, though. Because Ann Richards of Texas delivered a blistering broadside against Pappy Bush that featured the refrain, poor George, poor George, poor George, over and over again. And the signature line from her address was, poor George, he can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth. And I thought the Omni was going to implode from the force of the laughter. Ann Richards was brilliant. She was part of that class of brilliant Texas women that also includes the late, great Molly Ivins. Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth. Ann Richards is gone now. But mercy sakes, if she thought that George H.W. Bush, bailout Bush, was born with a silver foot in his mouth, she had no idea. Because back then, Bishop Willard Romney was just a little bitty baby hateful right-wing repig-licking. I mean, he'd dodged the draft and everything by then, but he wasn't on the radar. Oh, but he blipped up real good last night on Univision.
Now, for those that are already here and that are undocumented, that were brought here in here by their parents, and therefore are illegal aliens in this country, my view is that we should...
That are what? What'd you say there, Bishop Willard? That are what?
That were brought here in here by their parents, and therefore are illegal aliens in this country.
Yeah, illegal aliens. Illegal aliens. No, I will not play the Genesis song. Or is it just? Or was that one of Phil Collins' solo pieces? You don't use that phrase. Because there's no such thing, especially for somebody who touts the right to life and the sacredness and the sanctity of the lives of the little unborn fetuses, suggesting that it would be illegal to be a human being. You know, a little bit. What? Yeah, hypocritical, right?
My view is that we should put in place a permanent solution.
A permanent solution for the illegal aliens? Somehow that has kind of a familiar ring to it. Maybe this. No, that was Final Solution, the Pink Floyd reference. I don't know where did I hear that permanent solution? Oh, but do please continue, Bishop Willard, you parasite. By the way, did you know in the Pink Floyd song, I couldn't help yet waiting for the worms. Tapeworms? Hookworms? Oh, look, more parasites! Yeah. You know.
The president did was take no action when he had a Democrat House and Senate, even though he said he would, and then he put in place something he called a stopgap measure.
You filthy liar. Even when he had a 60-vote majority in the Senate, we never, ever had a 60-vote majority in the Senate, because that's those among those 60 votes that the Republicans like to tout now. It included people who aren't really Democrats, like Blanche Lincoln, like Ben Nelson of Nebraska, like Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and occasional partial Democrat Bill Nelson of Florida. But that one's gotten legs. That one's been used a lot. Like, I had 60 votes in the Senate and could have done any damned well thing he wanted to, and they didn't do it. They didn't fix America like they promised it would.
Temporary. These kids deserve something better than temporary. They deserve a permanent solution.
Yes, they deserve a permanent solution. Permanent solution. You know, final solution, permanent solution, lasting solution. You know, I'm just saying from the standpoint of a hillbilly who occasionally thinks about language and messaging and ideas and stuff. As a Republican, you don't want to be out there talking about solutions and putting adjectives in front of them. Especially if you're poor Willard Romney, who was born with a silver foot in his mouth. Michael writing in, when he's in the chat room, he's Kid A. Poor Willard, he can't help it. He was born with a silver head up his ass. There we go. Yeah. Yeah, and Bill, of course, remembers. Bill remembers the 2008 campaign. Bill in Cleveland, Mr. Stress. 2008 question: boxers or briefs? It was posed to the candidates, and you know, the Willard said magic underwear, and was it 2004? Anyway, they got around to McCain, and he said, "Depends." Ba-dum-bum. Well, I didn't have him in mind, Ron. Ron said, "Really, Bob? You want Geraldo Rivera to be a moderator for the debates? Maybe they could hold the debate in Al Capone's vault." Well, he's not the only TV for-profit media news person with name ending in a vowel, for heaven's sakes. I mean, I think the Univision folks were thinking about one of their own. Philip noting, "I don't understand Candy Crowley's name. I'm of large proportion myself, and I don't use raspberry or mint chocolate chip as my first name. Source and Wells sold wine. We husky herders have lost all modesty and humility." Irish Dave noting, "That's an unfair question to ask Bishop Mitt. Joseph F. Smith doesn't even make magic briefs and means you are therefore a religious bigot." Man, Irish Dave has figured out the code, hasn't he? Jeebus. Do tell us a little bit more there, Willard.
"And my view is that the ideas that were being brought forward by Senator Marco Rubio, those were things that should have been pursued. We should have had an answer. And my specific request is that for those young people, for instance, serve in our military, that they should be able to become a permanent resident of the United States. That's the kind of model I think that will work for these."
Yeah, not getting killed. That's really the key to the benefits plan.
Young people.
Yeah. You notice the place was as still as the tomb until he mentioned Marco Rubio? Now, this was done in Miami, so, you know, sort it out.
But with all due respect, your reluctance to provide details on a permanent solution has created maybe a perception that you are kind of evading the question. What would you tell Hispanic voters right now if they're actually...
Well, what I'd tell them is they have no business voting. Why aren't you talking American, lady? Big AAA so we all can understand.
Are very interested in this important issue, and all the dreamers that want to know if you become president, are you going to deport them or not?
Well, we're not...
Yes or no?
We're not going to round up people around the country and deport them. That's not...
It's the first place that question gets asked, and that's the first thing. Oh, I mean, you know, I'm talking about a permanent solution and everything, but we're not going to round up people and, you know, stick them in camps or anything. You know, that's what those camps that Kenyan Muslim with a deep-seated hatred of white people, that's what he wants. Aren't you following the teabaggers out there? Just ask them, they'll tell you.
I said during my primary campaign, time and again, we're not going to round up 12 million people. That includes the kids and the parents and have everyone deported. Our system isn't to deport people.
No, we're not going to deport them. Heck no. I'm not going to round them up and deport them. You're not going to go to all that trouble of rounding them up and then have all the extra hassle of deporting them, too. I mean, Jesus. Or Maroney or... umlaut, or you know, whatever your exclamatory Mormon phrase is.
We need to provide a long-term solution, and I've described the...
Now, I have played for you, unedited, except for my own comments, 1 minute and 36 seconds of this,
And how many times have they said permanent solution? With two, count them, two references to rounding them up and putting them in camps.
Bob?
Yeah, Doc? It may perhaps be helpful if I explain a bit about this.
Well, Doc, you're welcome to, because I got nothing here.
Well, you see, Bob, it's just like this. When they talk like that and they say things like permanent solution and round them up and put them in camps, it is because it is actually inside their psyches what it is that they want to do.
Really, Doc?
Oh, yeah. It's very easy. I have lots of experience with this. When I ask a patient, for instance, Bob, and I say, tell me about your mother, and the patient looks over at me from the couch, and the patient says,
I don't hate my mama.
Don't you love how I'm able to do that accent? I've had many years' experience, Bob.
Well, when I hear, I don't hate my mama,
when I ask the question, how do you feel about your mama, and I hear, I don't hate my mama, well, I know that there is deep-seated hostility in the patient's psyche that is bubbling just below the surface. And I know that there probably really is some animosity. So as such, then your Bishop Willard Romney, talks about wanting the permanent solutions and not wanting to put people in camps, we know, therefore, that he has actually sat around or at least been among people who have considered the possibility that putting people in camps might be a good idea. In Vienna, that's what we say when we mean good idea. So you see, Bob, it is far simpler than you think it is. That is why everybody calls this the Freudian slip. I identified it, Bob.
Well, bust my buttons, Doc.
Why you are keeping me on the retainer like this for nothing? I gotta work. Pass me a cigar, will you?
I reckon you earned it tonight, Doc.
Dankeschön. You're welcome.
How do you not hear that all those references to permanent solution and rounding up and putting in camps and not think, like the doc said, that maybe somewhere along the way that's been discussed?
You know, when the right wing spends all that time talking about the Obama FEMA camps where they're going to round us all up and put us for re-education and take away our liberty-loving conservative values.
That's actually kind of what they'd like to do to you.
Because there are far more manifesti out there written by right-wingers talking about how you and I think wrongly than anything we have. It's projection, isn't it?
Yeah!
Smoke your cigar, Doc. Irish Dave noting that months ago, Dana Milbank called the Simpleton Bowels Plan the final solution.
There's just some language out there that is freighted with so much emotional baggage that you don't use them. And that's one of them. You know. Unless you're a Republican. And then you can. The libertarian ophthalmologist Dr. Rand Paul, Senator. Did you catch that the other day? He declared that the government is Nazi. Yeah, well, I know it's just another day. Republicans do that every day. Democrats are the same as Nazis. Didn't you read the Jonah Goldberg book? Now, what would make Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, what would make Rand Paul declare that the government had done gone all Nazi on him? Mm-hmm. What would do that? Talking about permanent solutions and rounding people up and putting them in camps? No. No, silly. No, what made Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, declare that the government was Nazis, was full of Nazis, was a recent decision by the courts having to do with, I believe, 7 gold coins. Gold? Gold. 7 gold coins dating back to the time when the United States went off the gold standard, and 7 gold double eagle coins had been struck and were spirited out of the United States Mint at the time when having gold was made illegal. And they wound up in the hands of a collector. Did I tell you this story? You saw this, right? And lo, these many years later, the federal government found out where those 7 double eagle gold coins were and went and seized them. Because it was property of we the people, not property of the heir of the collector who had purchased them. For instance, if I run into you downtown and you just happen to be carrying a flat-screen television under your arm and you say, "Hey, man, you want to buy this TV from me?" Well, I mean, you're carrying it around. Does it work? Works great. It's practically new. Got the cord and the remote and everything. What do you give me for it? Oh, hell, I'll give you $25. Oh, can't you make it 50? All right, I'll do 30. 35? Done. And I get out $35 in legal tender currency, and I give it to you, and you hand me the TV. Well, one, there is something that attaches to that, and that is that I should either know or suspect, strongly suspect, that there is something fishy about the deal. But nonetheless, the cops ain't looking. So I go home and I set my flat-screen TV up on my little table and I plug the cable into it and I plug it into the power and I turn it on and I'm sitting there watching just glorious flat-screen high-definition wonderfulness. And then there's a knock at the door. I answer the door and there stands a man in green. Our state troopers wear green here. This is, nice looking TV you got over there, Bob. Well, thank you. Yeah, where'd you got it? Where'd you buy it? Bought it from a guy. Yeah, what guy? Guy down, don't know him. Had it walking around down. Well, Bob, that there TV's stolen, and I'm gonna have to seize it as evidence of crime. Really? Yeah, kinda am. Now, maybe there's a search warrant involved. I'm sort of jumping over some of the finer points for the purposes of all this. Well, that's what happened when the government seized those coins, those gold coins, that had been stolen from we, the people of the United States, trying to form a more perfect union in the first place. And, of course, the person from whom they were seized sued. There's my gold coins. They're precious and irreplaceable. There's only 7 or 8 of them in the world, and they're mine because Granddaddy done paid money to this guy in the back alley for him and everything. And there's value involved, and it's personal property, and my liberty's being deprived. And the court hearing the case, in what had to be sort of a judicial no-brainer, said no. No, just because you possess something, you know, possession is not 9/10 of the law. If you possess it and possess it because it was brought into your possession via illegal activity, you're out of luck, Buster. You don't get the coins back and you don't get paid for them because they were bought under suspicious circumstances in which the buyer should have known or did know that they were hot. Hotter than the interior of the sun. 7 double eagle gold coins that had never been before minted in this country were going to be brand new. The first few had only been recently struck, had never gone into circulation, should never have come out of the mint. No, you don't get paid. You're lucky you're not in prison. And as a result of that, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, declared that the federal government is just like Nazi Germany. Just like. Not similar to. Not vaguely comparable to. Just like Nazi Germany. Meanwhile, his party's candidate for president goes on Univision, and more times than Peter denied Christ, talks about permanent solutions and rounding people up and putting them in camps. It gets a little tiresome. A poor guy from California got disavowed from everybody from the White House on down for suggesting that the Republicans are engaging in the use of the big lie, a la Joseph Goebbels. But Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, feels no compunction whatsoever against comparing the government of we the people, who even in 2012 are still trying to form a more perfect union, to the Nazis, and enjoys the approval of his constituency by a wide margin, and will be in the Senate of the United States of America for at least 4 more years, at which point in time he will decide whether to run for a second term as senator from Kentucky, or perhaps instead to run for the presidency of these here United States. It gets a mite frustrating. You know, I've mentioned to you that magnificent film that I watched in Wisconsin, Body of War, by Phil Donahue. I'm not giving anything away, really, when I say that that early in the film there is footage of Senator Robert Byrd reading a quote on the floor of the Senate during the debate of the Iraq War resolution that begins, of course the people don't want war. The people never want war. And then describing how you manipulate the people into clamoring for war. And at the very end, he gives the source of the quote. Hermann Göring, president of the Reichstag. And I remember what a hissy was had over that.
Well, goddammit, Robert Byrd was a member of the Klan! And Grand Dragon!
I remember when the horrors of Afghanistan and Iraq were beginning to be noticeable inside the otherwise engaged mind of the American body politic. And Senator Dick Durbin, upon hearing of some of the abuses, said on the floor, he didn't compare, he said, if you heard of these abuses and you didn't know who had done them, you would swear it was a story from Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, and the right wing pounced.
Dick Durbin has called our American hero servicemen and women warriors over in Iraq and Afghanistan. He doesn't call them Nazis and commies. He's got to apologize.
And the country was on fire for two.
When will Dick Durbin apologize for it?
And he never called anybody anything. But here's Rand Paul saying that the government acting responsibly to recover property that belongs to we the people has done gone all Nazi because they sued to get back stolen property, because that's what it was, stolen property. Oh, that's good, Irish Dave. Or as they say about Baby Doc, meaning Rand Paul, or as they say about Baby Doc in Frankfurt, Ein Kentucky, Ein Volk, Ein Rand. Ein Rand, get it? Irish Dave's working on a toaster, too. Philip with a little bit of an admonition says, go easy on Mitt's performance, Bob. It's the first time he was surrounded by a crowd of immigrants from Spanish-speaking country since his father and older relatives died and he was nervous. Whoa. Mitt's permanent solution is to outsource all jobs to Mexico so undocumented immigrants and the members of the 47% can relocate en masse and leave this country to the real Americans who will, no doubt, play golf while planning the next outsourcing location. Fitzgerald Gatsby had it wrong. That green light at the end of his dock was the planet Kolob, shining in the distance and beckoning him home. Then again, I'm wondering, after I am posthumously baptized, how will I be fitted for special underwar before I leave for Kolob? Frankly, Bob, after years in the coffin, my boxers are going to be pretty stale, and I want to make a good impression when I get there. You don't have to worry about that, Philip, because, see, you're going to have a brand new body. You will be resurrected. I mean, it'll just be all new. Maybe everybody on the planet you go to will look like the dear Lord Willard. Lord Willard, and the creek don't rise. Sweet Jesus. But that's not all we have on this Thorn in the Side Thursday about Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. Oh, no. Not by a long shot. Got another Lulu here. Now, I admit, I was wrong. Jeb Bush did not run in 2012 like I figured he would. But then again, he's a Bush. He is disinclined. You know, he's like a buzzard. He's parasites. He's disinclined to go after even a not-so-strong incumbent. He wants an open field. And so too, I think, and this is where the I could be wrong part comes in, so too, I think, does Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. it could be quite between Eddie Munster, Ryan, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and Jeb Bush. 2016 could be really interesting. That is, of course, assuming that President Not Sure gets his second term. Which I hope is not too broad an assumption. But mercy. I mean, does that really, does that turn your stomach even just a little bit? The idea that trying to recoup stolen property of the U.S. government, which is, of course, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, at least in theory. Does that turn your stomach some? Does that make you feel just a little bit icky? Because it sure does me. It's so insulting to everybody who ever did anything to try to advance the cause of freedom. Not a poster, Dave. A toaster. We give out toasters here, not posters. He says, I am not working on a poster. It was 47% the way done, and I got lazy and quit. But no, there really is. There's more Rand Paul. But before we finish off with Willard Romney, it should be noted, Isaac pointing out to me a little bit ago via email, last night when he showed up on Univision, you know how in the secret tape he said, you know, if I looked a little bit Latino, this might be easier to do. Well, guess what? Showing up on Univision last night, Bishop Willard Romney appeared in brownface. Really. I don't know exactly what shade it was from the Ben Nye makeup kit, whether it was Bastard Amber or Navajo Brick. But he was definitely browned up because, you know, his hands didn't match his face. You can see the picture over at Gawker. You can see the picture over at Democratic Underground. The photo doesn't lie. Neetson Zimmerman writing at Gawker, it's gotten so bad that Romney is now resorting to brownface in order to make himself more appealing to Univision viewers. Or has it gotten it? Question mark. Democratic Underground has looked at the photo above from last night's presidential forum and concluded that, yes, Romney definitely dyed his face brown. Wonkette wonders if perhaps the GOP nominee was involved in some sort of self-tanner accident, or perhaps went out tanning with John Boehner for a little pick-me-up. Oh, there's a cute phrase. He was trying to win browning points with the audience. So there we go. There's the hours filibobster on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. I told you about it on your head, Jim, earlier in the hour, and he said, I used to watch soaps on Univision in D.C. Lord, they outdid Tammy Faye in the makeup department. Well, I think Willard's people did this, Jim. I don't think you can blame that on Univision. At least, not from where I sit. So we'll take a little break. It's time for the Green News Report. Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen on the way. And then you can jump in at your leisure. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This is Conversation Radio on America's listener-supported, liberal, progressive voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, September 20, 2012.
We are at last standing at a brand new start line.
Not so fast. Japan reverses course on nuclear phase-out.
We have 250 years of coal. Why wouldn't we use it?
Romney and the Republicans fight for big coal.
It was our decision, and we made the decision not to pay the people for the day.
With unpaid labor.
In some places in Maine, they're selling for as low as $1.25 a pound. Now that's
new record hot ocean temperatures causing a glut of lobsters. Plus,
it's necessary to stop this pipeline.
Putting their bodies on the line to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Oh, I doubt it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, a lot to cover today, so I'm tossing it right to you. What do you have for us today?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was fast. We reported on Tuesday the Japanese government had announced it would phase out all nuclear power by 2040, but then after heavy pressure from business and industry groups who say the policy will raise their energy costs, on Wednesday the Japanese cabinet suddenly abandoned that deadline.
So on Tuesday they were going to phase out all nukes by 2040, though there were some loopholes.
Oh, yes.
It was otherwise goodish news until Wednesday when they reversed the whole thing.
Right. And in contrast to Japanese businesses and industry, the Japanese public overwhelmingly supports phasing out nuclear power.
Well, who cares about them? Industry comes first.
Here in the U.S., Republicans are working hard for big coal this week. House Republicans have put up a slate of new bills promoting coal and attacking the EPA that they acknowledge will go nowhere and are just to score political points before the election. Energy analysts say that a steep drop in the use of coal in the U.S. is due to electric companies taking advantage of a glut of cheaper, cleaner natural gas. But Republicans and the Romney campaign are trying to blame the Obama administration for the drop in coal profits. Like this new ad from the Romney campaign.
They're wanting to close these mines down.
We have 250 years of coal. Why wouldn't we use it?
Because the free market says no. We're using the cheaper stuff instead.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I also want to point out that the coal miners that are standing behind Romney in that television campaign ad were required to attend that campaign event by their employer, Murray Energy. But the coal company refused to pay them for that day that they were forced out of work, as confirmed by Murray Energy's own Rob Moore.
We had managers that communicated to our workforce that the attendance at the Romney event was mandatory, but no one was forced to attend the event. As a private employer, it was our decision, and we made the decision not to pay the people for the day.
So it was mandatory to attend, but nobody was forced to attend?
Yeah, just try to figure that one out.
And they didn't pay them.
That's right.
Mitt Romney is using slave labor in his campaign commercials.
They got to lose a day's pay for the privilege of standing behind Romney.
Well, that gives a new meaning to free market, doesn't it?
A group of protesters today chained themselves to construction equipment to delay construction on the Keystone XL pipeline.
Fighting to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, although the northern portion of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline from Canada is on hold pending a new environmental review, construction of the southern leg of the pipeline is underway in Texas. Canadian pipeline company TransCanada has won numerous eminent domain court proceedings against Texas ranchers and homeowners who refused to sell. well. Protesters with Tar Sands Action in East Texas are chaining themselves now to Keystone Construction Equipment, temporarily halting work, tearing up trees and land for the pipeline, says Tar Sands activist Ron Seifert.
We hope to stop this pipeline. It's necessary to stop this pipeline. It's a threat to our constitutional rights. It's a threat to our future. And those directly impacted here on the ground, it's a threat to their families' health, safety, and security. Tar Sands pipelines have been leaking ever since they came online a few years ago. They're not to be trusted. They're untested. Even our national regulators don't know what to do with tar sands yet.
Finally, it's not just a record year for shocking Arctic ice melt. It's also a record year for hot ocean temperatures in the North Atlantic. NOAA scientists on Tuesday recorded the hottest ocean temperatures off the coast of the Northeast on record that reach all the way down to the ocean floor. The record warm ocean temperatures have further disrupted the already ailing commercial fishing industry in the Northeast, leading to a record massive glut of lobster that's caused the market to crash and is hurting struggling lobstermen.
So global warming, bad news for fishermen, delicious news for lobster fans.
Exactly.
For more of that bright side to global warming, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the hour, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. On our way now, a little more than a month away from our 7th anniversary as an internet-only experiment in conversation radio. Birthday is officially the 24th of October. I am going straight away to the phones, but I wanted to share something with you. This just came in from Shorty in L.A., and I thought you would find this interesting. You know, mentioned the Iraq War and the Afghan War, and yuck, and all the filthy lies that led up to it. Well, this is the Willard Romney ad, as Shorty notes, that is presently airing, urging us to put our precious children on the line with an attack on Iran for Israel. Here we go.
The fact is that every day that passes, Iran gets closer and closer to nuclear bombs.
Current U.S. policy rejects settling deadlines on Iran.
There's still time. And I say, wait for what? Wait until when?
The world needs American strength, not apologies.
You know, because that Kenyan Muslim with a deep-seated hatred of white people, he's just a-running around the country and all over the world, just apologizing and a-bowing and a-kissing. Well, no, wait, that's George Bush done all that kissing there amongst the bluebells.
As Shorty noted, however, this is interesting. Top comments at the YouTube site. Why don't you get a real job, idiot? Israel has nukes. Iran does not. Stop spouting crap, idiot. 180 comments. Wrong. Iran hasn't attacked another country in over 200 years. They aren't going to start now. They've signed and complied with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They allow for all inspections and they have been doing so. They claim all they're doing is enriching medical isotopes and striving for nuclear power plants. The CIA and others have looked into it and publicly reported there is absolutely no evidence they're doing otherwise. In other words, it looks like, as Shorty notes, folks aren't buying it. There's a simple comment. Join the United States Army and die for Israel. Another comment. I'm not going to die for Israel. Hey. You know, some folks would be more receptive to the idea of this looming existential threat if it weren't for the fact that some of us know, and maybe more of us than I suspect, that Benjamin Netanyahu is an old business crony of Bishop Willard Romney's. I don't know, maybe they both speak Reformed Egyptian or something. In my lifetime, I've seen some cynical politics. I mean, really, you know, Willie Horton ad that Lee Atwater came up with. You know, Willie Horton's going to get your mama. Vote Bush. All those smarmy, idiotic commercials that were run in the name of Ronnie Reagan. Morning in America and that kind of crap. But this may just take the cake. A presidential candidate, the first prince of any church ever to be nominated as a presidential candidate in the United States, and ads are being run on his behalf by featuring footage of one of his former business cronies urging the United States to send its own soldiers to their deaths against a non-nuclear country that is alleged to be threatening a country that has 200 nuclear weapons and one of the most advanced militaries on Earth. Man, if that's not a case of, come on, let's you and him fight, I don't know what is. Ray writing in, he said, by the way, Ray and Kim have made it to Florida. Just in the nick of time. You might be thinking about registering to vote down there, Ray. We could use some normal people voting. Ray says, I'm trying to think of what Israel has ever done for us. And the answer to that is precisely nothing. Nothing. I mean, you can go to the grocery store and get some decent tahini. But there is a Survivors Association of the USS Liberty attack who still remembers what Israel did to us. Nothing. Now, that's not to say I have any animus. I don't. I mean, I really do kind of wish that they would stop that slow-rolling genocide that they've got going against the Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied territories. I wish they'd unoccupy the territories. That'd be nice if they'd go into the boundaries that were actually established for the state of Israel. But I have no animus toward them. I just don't feel like the primary policy concern of the United States or the primary foreign economic concern of the United States should be propping them up. They've been around for 50 years now. Can they not do it on their own? I mean, really, do we, the people, have to go without access to meaningful health care so that Israelis can have it? Just asking. Mark, noting, many Americans are from Scotland, Ireland, England, Germany, Mexico, Puerto Rico. These actual native countries are not petitioning the USA for attacking anybody. Now, on the other hand, if you could have a sit-down with the Iranians and say, listen, guys, you don't want nuclear power. Did you catch the news out of Fukushima? You're in an earthquake-prone region. You don't want nuke plants. Wind and solar are in your future. You could generate enough wind. It's a big country. You could generate enough wind and solar energy to sell it to the entire region and make a fortune. But you see, that would be too sane a conversation, not for them, but for us. Because we can't see anything except through the bellicose lens that was given to us by the Israelis. If the single largest Jewish population in the Middle East outside of Israel itself were being persecuted and killed or rounded up, don't you think the Israelis would have already gone in? But they're not being. And yet this steady drumbeat. I have a 16-year-old son. And war tends to chew up and spit out young men and women. And I'm worried. I am worried indeed. To the phones we go.
Evening.
Hey, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Hey, Bill, what's up?
A lot of things. You got me. Man, you beat me to the livery. Beat me on that one, bud. I was just heading there when you mentioned it.
Hard to forget.
Yes. And I remember sitting at my desk in 1967 and pulling for Moshe Dayan, and I was pulling in the Iraqi Air Force, the Israeli Air Force for taking out Nasser's airplanes. Just, you know, I looked at things differently then.
Yeah.
And Nasser wasn't exactly a wonderful man either. In fact, I have this theory that maybe that guy on the all-night show that talks about all the aliens, maybe that's why when we need two people to sit down and talk peace, we get Netanyahu and Ahmadinejad. You know, it's like, where do these guys come from? And why are they the two people that are supposed to settle a situation peacefully? These guys couldn't toss dice in an alley without one stabbing the other.
I don't think a truer statement has lately been made on this program, Bill.
Well, thank you. Last week I heard somebody call a well-known leftist talk show host, one of the people I listen to and enjoy. And this guy was getting a letter, again, truth. This caller was saying, well, you know, the people in Europe had never had anything to worry about from Islamists. Never? Never?
Never.
Yeah. And the guy didn't correct him on it and say, well, you know, there was a time when, the Turks rolled out of Istanbul and laid siege to Vienna twice. That's quite a distance away. You know, it's not like right across the street. And when they got through the Balkans, they, like any conquering nation, regardless of who it is or where they come from, rob, steal, and kill somebody, you know. It was just the way things were, and we hoped that we'd get away from that kind of stuff. And that's what civilization is the more civilized we get, the less that kind of stuff should happen. But it did happen, and, you know, you can't... You wish you could...
But the problem, Bill, is that everyone, or not everyone, but so many people want to cast this as Islam versus Christianity.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, the last major attempt at crusade came in, what, the 1390s?
Yeah.
And culminated in the Battle of Nicopolis. And that's that was a victory for the Turks, largely because of the stupidity of the French military.
Yeah.
And this is not some setup for a joke.
No.
But the French military said they were not going to have the glory stolen from them by sitting there on their war horses while the peasants with their pikes and staves and so forth and spears and shields marched in and did the work that infantry does.
Yeah.
They were going to have honor and valor and glory, And they wound up marching all the way back into Turkey, barefoot and damn near naked. And as a consequence, but the thing is, there was such slaughter on both sides at the Battle of Nicopolis that the Sultan or she Sultan the Sultan Bajazet was so roughed up that he couldn't go any further either for a while. But of course, later on, they would march to Vienna and be turned away there. But it wasn't, you know, it's not. When we see these things, and I would be much more comfortable if we had somebody like Dr. John to opine on this, because I think he could put it in better terms.
Yeah.
But you know, when you see these things as population and immigration dynamics instead of because nobody says that the Huns rolled across Europe because they had a better religion.
No.
There were just lots of them, and they saw land for the taking, and mobile populations in need of land upon which to live, and so will go and take it by force.
Yeah.
In more ancient times, but the whole human dynamic of human life on this planet has been one of near constant motion.
Yeah.
For instance. The pants in a bunch reaction of the right wing in this country to people flowing back and forth across the Rio Grande or in the Arizona New Mexico desert and so forth, you know, that's only been going on for something on the order of 20,000 years.
Well, I know in our history, if you read some Dashiell Hammett stuff, you probably read some Continental Op stuff.
Oh, I've read Red Harvest, yes, and the Dane Curse.
Well, when he gets sent to, the op gets sent down to the territory of Arizona. It isn't a state yet when the story was written. And, of course, one of the underlying problems is people streaming across the border into Arizona. And that story was set before 1914. So, or another one about an Asian woman from San Francisco area whose property was being used to run immigrants from China through her backyard, offloaded from ships. So this has just started yesterday, you know.
But instead we have very short-sighted and bellicose people with ulterior motives, Bill, who insist in trying to recast this as some sort of religious warfare.
Yeah.
They want, you know, they actually kind of like the idea of religious warfare because of the bigotries that are inherent in their own sad and blistered souls. And it gets the rest of it gets the normal people in a terrible spot. It's a phrase that I've used for years, that us normal people are caught in the middle of a battle to the death between tastes great and less filling.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's about how much it matters. You know, I wish that... And it's been said repeatedly to the point that I think the U.S. is now running ads in Pakistan featuring Hillary Clinton and President Obama denouncing this dumbass YouTube clip that everybody's religion ought to be left alone. I wish instead, Bill, that we could say, why don't you religious people, all of you, stop being such faithless piss ants, and go practice your religion and leave the rest of us who want no part of it alone.
Exactly.
We won't burn your Quran, we won't burn your Bible, nobody, and we won't burn your Torahs, we won't burn your Rig Vedas, no. But for God's sake, settle down. And I say that to the Catholics, the Greek Orthodox, the Jains, the Hindus.
Yeah.
I mean, here, I can't forget, I just can't get out of my mind that story I heard a couple of years ago, Bill, about, and you know who the Jains are, right?
Yeah.
You know, there are certain vegetables that they won't eat because living animal creatures might be harmed in the harvesting of it. Okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, at one point in India, the Jains were going down the street and burning down restaurants. And burning down other religions' temples because they allowed the eating of meat. The Jains, right?
Yeah.
Who supposedly won't kill anything, but, you know, arson, eh. Well, you know, if somebody gets burnt to a crisp, that's, you know, that's the will of the god.
And by the way, congratulations on Fukushima. I hear that pronounced Fukushima over and over again, so I'm ready to, if I could afford to lose the hair, I'd tear some out.
I got straightened up on that early on, and I presume I'm doing at least a creditable job of it. I don't know.
No, you got it. I mean, I've read enough World War II pronunciations of Japanese city names and Japanese names to understand where the emphasis falls.
Well, linguistically, we like to put Europeans like to put the emphasis on the penultimate syllable. You see it a lot in Spanish, you see it in Italian, you see it in French, and you get some of it in English as well. So the European way of looking at that word is to say Fukushima, because we like that penultimate syllable for some reason or another, but it's not, as far as I understand.
Mentioning wasps, Bob, I know a half a dozen friends of mine who some of their family walk in here from Canada and settle down. And you never heard any griping about those folks sneaking across the border from Canada, because you could do it easily. I'd go into Canada with a boat behind a truck and cover on the boat, and I could have had everything from heroin to AK-47s under the, where are you going? I'm going to so-and-so fishing camp. Have a good time. You know, I remember one time the guy asked me a question, and the way he said it was, you have a gun? And I just looked at him and said, why should I? And things got rough up here or what? And he started laughing. He said, no. But you hit the pronunciation right. I'll give you one I heard a few years ago. A news reader was talking about a place in Virginia where there had been some violence, and I'll spell it the way it was pronounced. A-P-A-L-A-P-A-L-M-A-T-O-X.
Appomattox?
Appomattox. To me, it's always been Appomattox.
Yeah.
And I said, and they pay somebody to read this news?
Well, he just had his emphasis on the wrong syllable.
You got that right. And you were talking about the Meade statue. I had heard something about that statue, and I never knew what happened to it.
Well, it was it originally stood on the grounds of the Smithsonian, I believe, and then during some renovation or whatever, it wound up stuck in a warehouse, and then was rededicated in, I think, 1993, and it sits right there on Pennsylvania Avenue. I walked right past it, and of course I can't. Yeah, come on, Bill. I'm a nerd. I stop and I read historical markers, and I stop and look at statues. And you know, Meade
about being handed a rough job.
Yeah, it was a rough job, but he didn't. You know, he didn't last in that whole commander, supreme commander position very long.
Well, Grant came east in '64. And took command of and traveled with Meade. But George was handed the command of that army to face Lee, 7 days before the Battle of Gettysburg?
Yeah, because it had been Hooker before that, hadn't it?
Yeah, Hooker had quit in a huff over an argument with, Joint Chiefs, the Chief of Staff of, the guy came from the West. He was a nobody who sat there.
Halleck?
Halleck, yeah.
Yeah, he was an ass.
Yeah, exactly. And Halleck wanted to leave the troops at Harper's Ferry, and they got into a battle over that. And Hooker quit, which was no loss either. Hooker was
in charge when the Union got its rear end handed to it at Fredericksburg, wasn't it? That was Burnside.
Cantersville was his.
Yeah.
His disaster.
There's a period in the history of the Grand Army of the Potomac that's a little bit like Rome's Year of the Ten Caesars or whatever it was, where you know if it's Tuesday you've got a new commanding general.
Yeah.
Burnside, Hooker, Meade, and of course McDowell before all of those.
Yeah.
McDowell, who drilled his army to perfection but would not take them out and fight them.
McClellan, you think?
I mean, McClellan.
McDowell, McClellan, and then down, then you got it right from Burnside, Hooker. You know, Lee had a funny job. Lee had been superintendent of the point. And the historians say that he knew these men when they were younger than him and he was superintendent. And he knew their character. And he supposedly said in front of his staff officers when he learned that Meade was in command, he said, Meade's an engineer. He won't make any mistakes on our front. And he really didn't for 3 days.
And you know, back in the day, the engineers was the prestige posting out of West Point.
Well, I'll leave you with one more story about me that's so ironic during this, all this birth of crap. George Meade's family were in the diplomatic service to the United States government. They were assigned to Spain when he was born, in Spain. And there was talk muttering amongst civilians when he became commander of the Army of the Potomac that he was not an American citizen. There was this kind of crap floating around. So you begin to wonder, what is new after a while? Is there anything really, anything inanely stupid that hasn't been done before?
I think you can find an example of it everywhere along the way. And that particular statue, that Meade statue, it was 1923 when they put it up. But it's kind of bizarre. You know, all the other generals are in typical fashion.
Typical military fashion.
They're depicted on horseback. General Thomas. But the Meade statue is all allegory, and you have to go somewhere, because I stood there looking at it going, what does this mean? Because on the one hand, you got a naked girl taking his cloak off. On the other side, you got a naked guy taking his cloak off. And all the, you know, all the nasty bits are just conveniently concealed by the way that the statues are posed. And they're taking a cloak off of Meade, and then behind it, there's a guy that I can only say looks like a Star Trek Romulan, because he's got the helmet with the nose guard coming down and everything. And he's got these big-ass wings coming off the back of him. I'm going, man.
Who designed this?
Yeah, I mean, this sculptor must have had a bad night with the absinthe.
Jesus.
And then, of course, I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I found out that the naked girl is chivalry, and the naked guy is valor, and there's a couple of other naked people and they're all the qualities of a great general. And they're removing from him the cloak of warfare. It's almost like some sort of campaign ad or something, but the guy had been dead for years.
A long time, yeah. Yeah, he was in his 50s, I think, when he was running the Army of the Potomac, and he actually kept Lee at his distance for the rest of 1863. I mean, Lee never could pull some of the stunts. He tried a couple times.
Gettysburg just crippled him up too much.
Yeah, both of them. And but it's just sometimes you wonder after a while what the hell is going on. And with this Willard, is this man just plain nuts, or was he put up there and told, "Hey, we'll give you a lot of money to lose the election"?
I heard somewhere today that he's closed down his New Mexico operations, that they've basically given up on New Mexico.
And Michigan.
Yeah, that was all part of the Hitler finds out about the secret Romney tapes thing that was.
Yeah.
Oh God, funny.
I'll have somebody else, but I do. Because I've had this. My first visit to Gettysburg was at age 17 by myself. And I took cabs out on that field, and I walked around it. And I had a nice Japanese reflex camera. You know, the kind you look down on top.
Yeah.
And it must have cost hardly anything. But cause that would have been 19... Well, if I was 17, that was 1960 I was there. So, and I just would walk for miles. I got down to that Spangler Spring by Culp's Hill.
Mm-hmm.
It was getting late in the day, And I panicked, and I got the hell out of there. I could just feel things that I didn't like feeling. And I had to get out of this. Sometimes you wonder about all that
stuff. Oh, you walk around inside those giant boulders of Devil's Den, and it just feels creepy, Bill.
Devil's Den was an example of what the guys were going through over in Iraq and Afghanistan with these explosives. The concussions of the Union artillery was hitting these guys at Devil's Den. They were supposedly had, some of them didn't have a mark on them.
But the concussive force, yeah.
And it was doing them in. That's that field, well, Antietam's the same way. Now, you told me you've been to Shiloh and you walked away with some creepy feelings.
Yeah, that's a, yeah.
What is that? What is the one has the pond?
The Bloody Pond, right.
Shiloh, yeah.
And when you're a kid and you take your first trip to Shiloh, because, you know, they take kids there like sixth grade, I've been four or five times on field trips. It was about, you know, maybe 70 miles away or, you know, not even that. And, ooh, we're going to see the Bloody Pond. And you know how little boys are. Well, is there still blood in it? No, that's set, that's settled. But it's all there. And the, you know, the hornet's nest and the
Ohio
big...
Ohio was there, apprentices people with the hornet's nest, yeah.
And of course, you know, the at least the stump of the tree where Albert Sidney Johnston fell off his horse.
Yeah. Amazing. And, you know, Americans, there was only 15,500 men in the U.S. Army in 1861. And we were 18th in the world in 1938 as far as manpower.
Yeah. But what did I hear the other day? I mean, we might want to think twice about Iran. They've got the fourth largest military in the world.
It could be problems. And for what? What is the same thing I used to argue with people about Vietnam? I said, you're right about the moral part of it. It's immoral as hell, but in the most practical sense, what the hell is in it for us? Why the hell, what are American citizens going to gain?
Well, you know, it only took a generation, but we finally made Vietnam safe for Nike.
Yeah, now they can make clothes for us, and, yeah. Oh, brother. Anyway, you enjoy the rest of the night and hang in, man.
I'm going to try. Bill, it's awful good to hear from you.
Take care of yourself.
Bye now. That's our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. We do these history things here sometimes. I think over the years, Dr. Bill and Professor Keith have just rubbed off on me. I love history because I like to think it gives us enough of a sense of perspective to anticipate future mistakes. And if we know history, maybe not make those mistakes. That's the whole purpose of it. At least I think. You know, the Thucydides is credited with being the first Western historian, and he said something about that. You know, I'm not recording the, he says, you know, so that people will know what was, you know, screwed up. And, you know, he had fought in the Peloponnesian War. And it's, you know, his Melian dialogue serves as a warning today, to this very day. Great nations do as they wish, small nations do as they must. And that was a case of a so-called democracy, Athens, trying to strong-arm the people of a small island into joining their democratic empire. Where have we heard that before? Where have we heard that? Sandra just wrote in. We heard the Netanyahu ad a minute ago. She says, Sandra says, this ad is going to run in Florida, and who knows who's funding it? And for some reason, it's, come on, it's going to load, it's going to load. I think my computer's not going to cooperate. Well, I'll work on it. In the meantime, we've got lines open if you want to get in on the conversation. It's about 13 minutes before 8 o'clock here on the East Coast. 13 before 5 Pacific time. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Andy, what's up?
Boris Johnson alias here, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I had a good conversation with Bill on Gettysburg. Guy used to love going over there. My father was a real Gettysburg buff. I went to college real close to there. And when my father would come visit me, he'd stay in Gettysburg and go through the fields. I often think about how brave the Minnesotans were. I think it was the Iron Brigade.
Wisconsin.
That was the Wisconsin guy?
Yeah, Wisconsinians will get real uppity with you if you suggest that the Iron Brigade came from Minnesota.
I always thought Duluth was the place that iron was really...
Well, but there was serious... I mean, but they were the Iron Brigade because they had the strength of iron, just like... It was a propagandistic counterpoint to the Stonewall Brigade. Because, you know, the Stonewall Jackson had the Stonewall Brigade because, you know, and that came from the First Battle of Manassas. The tide turned in that battle when somebody said, look, there stands Jackson like a stone wall.
Right.
Yeah. But it was, and the Iron Brigade was the one that had in it young Arthur MacArthur, who led the charge at Chickamauga.
Hmm. Got your history down. It was the Minnesotans, though, that did hold off Pickett's charge, right?
I believe so, yeah.
And they were vastly outnumbered.
Oh.
And I believe they lost, like, 70-80%.
But they had a real advantage on that third day because they were behind a wall. And it was said that as we think of a charge as a whole bunch of people just running pell-mell toward an objective. A charge was not that within the Civil War context. It was an orderly march, frankly. And at Fredericksburg, the Confederates had the advantage of the Stonewall on Mary's Heights and had mowed down Union soldiers like sheaves of wheat. And some of the survivors said that as they got near the wall where the Union forces were, that all the Union soldiers behind that wall on the day of Pickett's charge were simply chanting, Fredericksburg, Fredericksburg, Fredericksburg.
Wow.
See,
yeah,
when you grow up in the South, you wind up learning this stuff.
Right.
And I think there's a certain psychosis involved with it. But, Faulkner even wrote about it. What it means. Down there, and it means something that it doesn't mean to somebody from Wyoming or Idaho or Oregon,
right.
But it means something. Fighting Bob Fest North that I attended in May up in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, John Nichols from The Nation, who was an awesome speaker. You see him on TV and he's all staid and sedate and oh well, yes, of course. Man, he gets behind a microphone and back in his home state of Wisconsin, and he breathes fire. And he had that crowd lit up, telling them this was before the recall election, talking about the heroism of the Iron Brigade, and that whole audience was ready to run out and go and remove Scott Walker from office by force if they had to.
That's good. Yeah, I've gotten on radio shows and been able to ask John Nichols questions, which is pretty cool. I think he even recognizes my voice now in the Bay Area.
Well, he's a smart guy.
Yeah, no doubt. He gets a lot of airtime, no question about it, with his commentaries.
I ought to get him on this show just for the fun of it.
Yeah, you should. You know, concerning... what you were mentioning before, you covered a lot of ground, you know, going from the Middle East to the Civil War. But when it comes to Israel, it's all a first strike. I mean, you look at 67. That was a first strike against Syria, Egypt, and Jordan. When they went into Lebanon in the 90s, that's first strike. When they went into Lebanon again in 96, that's first strike. When they attacked the West Bank and the Gaza, and they recently went into Gaza in like 2000, that's first strike. I mean, that's what they do, and the same thing with Iran. They don't need a pretext. They just do it. Yeah, and that's why the USS Liberty wasn't a major reason to stop that ship from being able to report back what was actually going on in the 67 war. An interesting thing is a documentary done by the BBC on the USS Liberty, which is very detailed. And one thing that just fascinates me is they couldn't get to the men underneath that were injured because they got hit by torpedoes and the doors were locked into the engine room. And so, you know, they were really beat up and battered. I think it was like 49 men died. And when they finally got to Cyprus and they got down to the hole where the men were that were killed, they said it was just horrifying. It was like a meat locker in there with all the body parts strewn all over the place and hanging. That it was just horrifying. And, you know, the men who were on that ship will never forget what they went through, what the Israelis did to them. And I don't understand our government. I really don't understand the whole Israeli thing. You know, our leadership is one way with Israel. But you saw at the convention when Antonio Villagrosa asked for a vote to move the embassy to Jerusalem, or to make Jerusalem the capital, to put that in the democratic plank, and they asked for the verbal vote, and it went the other way all three times. The people are not with our leadership on Israel. I mean, there should be no question about that. We are not with you. You are alone. And this Israeli thing is destroying our nation. And they are just, they really are. It's just a, you know, this is a theocracy. This is the worst of the worst, what happens when super racism takes over and you see a bought and paid for government at the leadership ranks. But the people are not there. And the people even at that convention were not there. They do not want to move the embassy or move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem or make Jerusalem the capital.
Well, no. You know, why would you? I mean, what's the point in I mean, that is, for all intents and purposes, putting up something, hanging an American flag outside of it, and a big sign next to it saying, bomb here.
Right, why antagonize these people over an issue that should be negotiated?
Because when we antagonize them, then we prove that they're the barbarians, right?
Yeah.
And it makes me nuts, Andy.
I don't even want to get into this religious garbage with this video. That was totally ridiculous, and this whole thing is so stupid, just like you said. Would they just go into a corner and screw around with themselves and leave us out of it? Because this is so stupid, so ridiculous. The other thing, you had a conversation with Grant maybe a week or two ago concerning the bishop.
Yeah, that would be two Fridays back, or two. Would be 2 weeks ago tonight.
You know, I read an article about Bishop Willard, and, you know, he, being a bishop, he was responsible, I think, for like 500 to 1,000 of his flock in the Boston area. And I believe he had to know each one of them by name, and they would go to him for consultation. They look up to him. They revere him. He tries to help them out, especially with their financial situations and getting ahead in life. It's not like this guy is some has-been or something. He is a role model.
Yes, I mean, it was as a prince of the church that he went to that woman who had been a babysitter or whatever for them, who was pregnant but had been estranged from her husband, and said to her that she needed to give her child up, with whom she was pregnant, to adoption by a good Mormon family, and that if she didn't do it, she would never go to heaven.
Right, he makes those kind of decisions. So to think that this guy's religion or that his bishop status doesn't have merit or doesn't weigh convert, it sure does. It means a lot. This is the core of his being, because that's what he's been doing for a good part of his life, is being a bishop and being responsible and for uplifting the people in his flock so they get ahead.
But the question I have coming out of that, Andy, is, you know, Jimmy Carter was a Sunday school teacher, all right? and, you know, brought his faith with him to the White House. He was a Sunday school, not even a deacon. He was just a Sunday school teacher. And
job creation numbers in a four-year term.
Yeah, the highest job creation in a four-year term of any president since Johnson?
Well, since 57 was when the chart started.
Right. But the highest, you know.
Right. You would never think that the way he is maligned.
Right. Well, and that's why I have said, you know, I have no tolerance for it. And when right wing, Jimmy Carter. Well, the fact of the matter is, Jimmy Carter was a good president with a lot of good ideas.
Darn right he was.
And history will judge him a lot more favorably than they will that greasy-headed old warmongering freak Reagan.
Absolutely.
And history, I think, will damn the voters of the United States for getting sucked into Reaganism. But the thing that I think discourages me more, I'm used to having right-wingers, Jimmy Carter, you know, what a panty waste, me. But the ones that bug me are the people who allege themselves to be Democrats. You know, why in the hell was not, and I mean, I, you know, you and I can, we talk like this to each other, Andy. Why in the hell was Jimmy Carter not personally on that stage? When is the Democratic Party going to stop running from Jimmy Carter?
Or Howard Dean.
But Jimmy Carter in particular deserves not only our tolerance, but our admiration. And, you know, there's a great deal of irony. I got an email from our buddy Dennis in Kentucky with whom I guess I'm done mowing grass for the year. But he sent me an email saying, how about a slice of karma pie? And it was an email talking about the fact that the guy who was instrumental in getting the 47% video released is, of course, the son of Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The
guy from Mother Jones, Korn, David Korn, worked with him.
Yeah, he got it to Korn, and then Korn broke it.
Yeah. I'd like to know who exactly at that meeting with Mark Leader at that party actually took the video, though. That's the I wonder if it was one of the workers there, you know, one of the waiters or something, or was it actually a rich private equity dude who set it up and is going to remain incognito?
Right, or, you know, was it one of those teabaggers who hates Willard Romney?
True.
And wanted to sink him. Yeah, this thing that came from Dennis said, for 30 years, Republicans have vilified him unfairly. His grandson just helped leak a video exposing Mitt Romney. How do you think a 30-year-old slice of karma pie tastes? So it was Jimmy Carter's grandson,
yeah. Yeah, that's great. Hey, you were going on about Jimmy Carter being a Sunday school teacher. I'm sorry, I was just
pointing out that, you know, that's about the closest we've gotten to a Sunday school teacher is about the closest we've ever gotten in the presidency to having a religious figure, or a religious authority figure in the White House. But now we've got a full on bishop, and I don't care if you're a Methodist bishop, a Mormon bishop, an Episcopal bishop, a Catholic bishop, a Jewish rabbi, or a Muslim imam, or any other kind of priest or holy man or shaman. Having one in the White House gives me the creeps. Because you can't rise to that level in the hierarchy of any given faith without being driven by that faith.
I agree. 100%. 100%. Hey, your Mountaineers are kicking some donkey.
With
the opening game, 69-34 against Marshall. Oh, jeez. And then they whipped up on, Madison?
Yeah, JMU.
James Madison?
Yeah,
whipped up on them the next week.
And this week it's Maryland, my Maryland, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, they don't really go into the meat of their big, you know, they look like gangbusters right now.
Oh, that guy Geno Smith.
And Geno Smith is being touted as Heisman material.
Yeah, 411 yards, I think he had passing against James Madison.
But everybody keeps saying, "Wow, yeah, we really don't know anything about them, because they haven't played anyone yet." And I guess there's a certain amount of truth to that, but it'll get interesting real quick here pretty soon, because let's see, after Marshall and then JMU. Next, this Saturday, day after tomorrow, is the Terrapins of Maryland. And I know, our buddy Tosh will be out there. He's a good Terrapin. Then we get Baylor. Then we travel to, and there's no way I can make the trip, but I was actually invited to Austin, to see the game at Texas, and how I would love to see that. Then Texas Tech, Kansas State, the Horned Frogs, at Oklahoma State, and Oklahoma, and that'll be the game. Oklahoma comes to Morgantown on November the 17th.
I'll tell you, Bob, that sounds like a pretty grueling schedule.
Oh, it's real ugly from about 13th. It's relentless from the 6th at Texas, at Texas Tech, then home to K-State, open date. Home for TCU, at Oklahoma State, home for Oklahoma, at Iowa State, and then home for the Kansas Jayhawks.
Now, the problem with such a tough schedule at that is just the beat-up effect. They might win the battle, but lose the war because too many guys get hurt if you're playing such tough competition. That's a tough schedule.
And and that's long travel, too.
Yeah.
And that long travel will wear you out.
Right, that's a beat up. Some guys are going to get beat up pretty bad.
And I don't know, it'll be interesting. I badly wanted the Mountaineers to go to the SEC, but I suspect, Andy, that the SEC didn't want anything to do with the Mountaineers, because every time we've run up against an SEC team in the last few years, with the exception of losing a close game to Auburn and a close game to LSU, we've come out on top, especially in bowl games. And then the ACC really didn't want anything to do with WVU. That's why they offered Pitt and Syracuse bids into the ACC and left us flapping in the breeze. You may remember what happened in the bowl game at the beginning of this year. We hung, 70 points on Clemson that was supposed to mop the field with us? Yeah.
Well, that's really where you belong, I think, is the SEC. I mean, it makes geographic.
Right. Well, I mean, Kentucky is in the SEC. It'd be a nice border state rivalry.
Right.
We've got a long history of playing ball with South Carolina. We've had interesting bowl games with Georgia. We had a nice home and home with Auburn. It just made sense.
Right. Just real quick, getting off of college football. I sent you some articles on the private equity funds.
Yes.
How they're getting investigated, because of what they've been doing is, and Bain has been one of the main, provocateurs or firms that have been doing this, taking fees out of these companies, management fees, and then converting them back into their funds so they become capital gains. And they're under investigation with a lot of other big name funds that have been doing the same thing. So
yeah, I looked over those articles, and but the first question that came to my mind is, investigate Schmestigate, is anything going to come of it?
Right.
I mean, if you stone cold bust them and catch them with their hands in the cookie jars, what happens to them, Andy?
Well, they should be paying that money back to
yes.
the government. They're saying, off of $1 billion in fees, there's probably a couple hundred million worth of taxes that aren't being paid. And you do have Eric Schneiderman, the New York AG, working on it. But
why is it that we have to rely on states' attorneys general instead of federal government that should be doing the work?
Say Eric Holderman. Because maybe Eric Holderman is afraid, and Mr. Obama are afraid to upset their good buddies on Wall Street by doing something like that. You know, Eric Holderman doesn't.
And by good money, by good buddies, you mean donors.
Right, Tim Geithner's pals. Right, you don't want to upset Jamie Dimon and shine another black eye on Wall Street over this. But an amazing thing, too, that they say the Carlyle Group and Blackstone, two of the largest private equity purveyors of predatory capitalism, aren't even doing that. They deemed it illegal. Their legal staff, tax staff, wouldn't do this particular conversion of management fees. They consider it income. So it's interesting that two of the larger private equity firms are not doing it and deem it illegal, yet Bain, among a number of others, found it to be an illegal practice. So there's a problem here. There's a problem.
A big problem. You know, and that was one of the things. There were two people that really, I'm not saying that their addresses were better, but there were two people whose addresses really stood out for me at Fighting Bob, Andy. And let me say by way of a digression, one of the things that Ed Garvey, who made Fighting Bob happen at the suggestion of Jim Hightower, who wanted to have a series of Chautauquas all over the country, one of the things that that he pointed out early on is that he would like, he wants to know, you know, do people want to see this idea spread out? And I got to thinking of, you know, Fighting Bob South, and giving progressives from all over the South one place to gather and really raise their voices. My God, wouldn't that be cool? You know,
you could do it in Beckley.
No. Nashville? Oh, I'd do it in Nashville in a minute.
Yeah, that'd be a good central location.
Or you know, or have a you know a you know something along those lines up east. Or out west, yeah, I think it would be brilliant. But two of the speakers there that I paid close attention to, one came on in the morning, and that was Buddy Romer. And of course, he's an ex-Democrat, ex-Republican. And the crowd warmed to him, and he had that Southern politician charm about him that's kind of hard to resist. I mean, Southern politicians are good at it. Yeah, because they're kind of down homey and all shooks and all of that
yeah,
stuff.
But when you get into detail about Buddy.
Yeah, that's what I was getting. That's where I was going to.
He's not good.
No, he's not. Except, you know, but his message there, you know, his message there at Fighting Bob was that we're in a mess and they're all rotten. And I thought about things I've been saying on this program for a while. When you tell people that everybody's rotten, well, anything that keeps people away from the polls always inures to the benefit of the right wing.
Right, that broad brush stereotyping is not the right thing to say. That's not.
But then later in the afternoon, along comes Jill Stein, and you know
she got my vote.
I agreed with every blessed thing she said.
Yeah, she's got the right policies, just not the right party.
Yeah, and this is you know this is the dialogue I would like to sort of foster and engender, Andy. I would like, what if all of those good ideas were pushed into the Democratic Party? Because I get the idea that there's a lot of people out there that say it just can't happen. That the Democratic Party can never again be a progressive party like it was under FDR and Truman, and that the Democratic Party that gave us Kennedy and Johnson.
Well, that's a load of horse hockey. Anything's possible.
Well, then why can't? This is where I'm struggling, and please bear with my.
We're trying, man. We're trying at the grassroots. I think the party is one way on the grassroots with the people, but it's another way with the leadership. Our problem is with the leadership of the Democratic. They're not with us. They are not with us.
Right.
Rahm Emanuel is so far removed from me or Bill Clinton with his policies and what he says and does. It's ridiculous. I'm not on the same page as those people. And they're the leaders.
Nor I. I mean, but I guess
I'm not with Nancy Pelosi either. Not there. She's in a different world. She really is.
And I guess the question I'm asking is, And I know, and I'm asking you this question because I know you are working down in the grassroots. You know, you wrote into the show yesterday evening talking about the conversation you had with Jackie Spears' staffer.
Right.
About the ACAG.
I happen to know her. I've met her before, so it was kind of cool.
And, you know, what
and
we're
I'll
hearing
probably
is...
probably meet her in a month or two, actually. We're gonna,
what we're hearing is that we've got to have people in her district really tell her, damn it, you got to sign on.
And the problem is, when I do meet with my local DFA group, which is the biggest, and I've told them at the last three meetings, I've told them about the bill, told them to call, but I just don't think they do it. Unfortunately, it's hard to get the enthusiasm and to get people, you know, it's always hard to get people to do things, especially when it's so far.
You've either got to make them, you've got to either make them mad, make them sad, or make them glad.
Just not enough environmentalists in the group, I guess.
Well, and the but the thing is, Andy, you know, I wish in a way that there was some way for me to talk to them, because I don't need them to be environmentalists. I need them to be people who care about whether babies can breathe.
Yeah, I understand. I understand totally. I know. I'm with you. I just don't know what it, the problem is. Too, we just can't seem to get younger people and people that have more of their skin in the game of this planet. A lot of the people in the political realm in the group I meet with are retired. You know, they just don't have the skin in the environmental game because their their years are numbered, and that's not doesn't seem to be their main. Younger people don't get involved.
That in its own right is troubling, because
likely people to help.
I don't want to, you know, I don't want to run off into and tout my geezerhood, but you know,
I'm 5 years older than you, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, right, and the thing is, I'm not quite 50. I will be in January.
Right. I'm well over 50.
And this is no slur, and this is no criticism, but there were a lot of people at Fighting Bob. And I was part of the younger contingent.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's, you know, there's some of that stuff that you and I have talked about in the past, Andy. The fact that, and maybe that's the problem. Maybe we are witnessing inside the progressive community a phrase that we haven't seen since, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, the so-called generation gap, where maybe I don't get it anymore. I mean, I don't feel like an old fart, and I doubt you do either. And probably most of the people who are in their 60s and 70s and 80s who listen to this program don't feel old. They feel like they've got as much in common with a young person as a young person. But, you know, I sense, for instance, that there is one, and that gap is also being fostered to keep us divided. You know, I'd love to see a room full of young progressive people, but they also have, you know, they have lives, and they have school that they're in, or you know, young families, young careers that they're building. And that's one of the greatest questions I think we have to answer, is how do we engage the people who are going to be in this struggle 40 years from now, when you and I and much of the Horn family aren't? There has to be some way of transmitting, and I've talked about this in the past as well, that one of our great shortfalls or failings is the lack of transgenerational wisdom and the lack of transmission of transgenerational wisdom. And I don't know how we do that. I think one of the most brilliant manifestations of it being done successfully is probably being done by Bill McKibben, because he's got a lot of young people involved in the struggle for climate and the struggle against the tar sands pipeline and the struggle that we saw growing out west against the expansion of coal export ports out around Bellingham, Washington, and so forth. But I'd still like to see a greater coming together. And I guess to tie this back toward where we started, if we took some meaningful percentage of those energies, Andy, and put them into changing the Democratic Party, and by doing it, by running for county commissioner and city council and, you know, library board and ward healer or, you know, whatever, instead of what I call these vanity campaigns for president and Congress and senator that take millions of dollars that people don't have, then I think you see change. I think you see political change and policy change and philosophic change be a much more likely outcome. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, other than bringing back a Howard Zinn, you mentioned Bill McKibben. And Bob, if my phone goes out, I'm just going to have to leave because my phone's low on
I understand. Battery. I'm sorry about that.
If I go, you just go to somebody else. But I noticed that. And we have the GMO movement here, Proposition 37, to get the GMOs labeled. And I notice with that, we seem to attract a lot more younger people, a lot more professional younger people who are really psyched about getting that passed and being the first state to do that. And a lot of those people do not get involved with the party-oriented type groups or initiative. But when it comes to an issue item, the younger people seem to more gravitate to that. And I see a lot more younger people.
And it happened. But I think I understand what Andy's getting at. And maybe that's because the direct issue related things are more likely to be present in the everyday lives of people. You know, it is morally outrageous, for instance, to know that the Republicans blocked a bill that would benefit veterans yesterday. It's morally outrageous. But unless you are military or you've got someone near and dear to you in the military, it's kind of esoteric. On the other hand, however, was that redundant? On the other hand, however? On the other hand, if you've got something like Prop 37 in California that affects the stuff that you eat and put into your body, you get a much more immediate sense of skin in the game, and the same thing attaches to the tar sands. And I hope the same thing attaches to the AIC Act, because the AIC Act speaks to things that are happening to babies that have been born and will be born tonight and will be born tomorrow and the year after, a year from tomorrow, and will continue to be afflicted and beset by horrors until such time as we stop this madness that is nothing but a scourge and a penalty upon people for the accident of their birth in this tormented region of the country. And maybe that's part of the connection. I don't know. Andy brought up the issue of GMOs, and I should say the lines are open if you want to get in on the conversation. And we've got a good, 35 minutes of conversation available left in the program. 877-443-2366 is the number. 304-658-3333 is the direct dial number. Either one comes into the same queue, so feel free to light them up for the remainder of the program. Maybe... when you know that these corporate parasites, I'm really going to try not to use predators anymore. When you know that these corporate parasites are willing to subject an entire planet to famine in order to fatten their purses, maybe that becomes a little more visceral because you are included in that. Andy mentioned GMOs, and wow, headline from my stack from yesterday. French study finds tumors and organ damage in rats fed Monsanto corn. Remember the story from a couple of weeks ago about the fact that Frankencorn is about to go into your local Wally World, and you won't have any way of knowing that it's Frankencorn because Wally World ain't gonna label it? Rats, this is a story by Mike Ludwig at Truthout. Rats fed a lifetime diet of Monsanto's genetically engineered corn or exposed to the company's popular Roundup herbicide developed tumors and suffered severe organ damage, according to a French study released yesterday. The study could have a big impact on the battle over a California ballot proposal that would require groceries containing genetically engineered ingredients to be labeled as such. Monsanto has already donated $7.1 million to the campaign to defeat the proposal known as Prop 37. That's what Andy was talking about. Here's the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of the study. It links varying levels of both Roundup herbicide and the transgenes. Transgenes. You know, you'd think the right wing would be upset about transgenes. Little genes and chromosomes running around with feather boas and, you know, listening to Barbra Streisand music. The study links varying levels of both the Roundup herbicide and the transgenes in Monsanto's patented NK603 corn. Whatever happened to Silver Princess? Whatever happened to Early Sunglow? No, now Monsanto is breeding corn, genetically modifying corn, that sounds like the call sign for a freaking starship. The rats were either fed the NK603 corn alone, corn treated with agricultural levels of Roundup, or given water treated with Roundup at low levels commonly found in contaminated drinking water and used in agriculture in the United States. That kind of covers the bases, doesn't it? In each group, there were 2 to 3 more deaths compared to control groups, and the rats on the Monsanto diet died more quickly. So the most poisonous thing is just eating the damn food. That would be us. And then there's the folks who get some of it in their water, and they get sick too. Right? Nice. The rats, according to the researcher, Gilles-Éric Serralini, I like to drag my French out and mispronounce it once in a while, a professor of molecular biology at the University of Caen, who led the, Northwestern France, who led the research team, told reporters on Wednesday that the rats' diet reflected the kind of exposure that humans who eat genetically engineered food should expect. This is around the level that the American population may eat, where unfortunately GMOs are not labeled. In Europe, we have this labeling, and it helps us to avoid these compounds if necessary and promote personal choices. The research team concluded that NK603's transgenic traits and the endocrine-disrupting effects of Roundup herbicide could explain the results. The study is the first of its kind to link enzymes overexpressed by transgenes to health problems. Here's the fun part, and as someone who is working on getting the AIC Act passed, this means something to me. Endocrine-disrupting chemicals cause health problems and cancers by impacting hormonal glands in mammals and are especially dangerous to children. Pesticide and herbicide critics often fear that chemicals used to kill weeds and pests could potentially be endocrine disruptors in humans. If it kills some life, odds are it'll kill most life. So one of the things that I will be watching for come November is what happens with Prop 37 in California. How could you not? But as I mentioned the other night, the thing that scares me is that if Prop 37 passes, it will immediately be tied up in the courts. It will go up to the California Supreme Court, and whatever happens in the California Supreme Court, or I should say, if it is upheld in the California Supreme Court, Then it will go to the Supreme Court of the United States, who will strike it down as a violation of interstate commerce insofar as it is a more stringent requirement than that imposed by the federal government. Now, see, for instance, here in West Virginia, we can have less stringent requirements than the federal government for, say, poisoning communities with mountaintop removal, and the federal government says, cool! See how it works. But that's not a reason, if you're in California, not to go out and vote for Proposition 37. You gotta at least manifest the popular will. And then if it falls, it will fall not by a function of popular will, but by a function of partisan political hacks. The rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, plus Kennedy. The Stark. That would be Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Roberts, and Kennedy. The Stark justices of the right wing of the Supreme Court. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Well, hello. Is this Gigi?
Yes.
Second call, and I still remembered your voice.
I'm very impressed. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Okay. I had to call because you were talking about food, and I've always said that I think our food is killing us. And I had this conversation just this morning with my sister-in-law who, well, let me backtrack. About 8 years ago, this time 8 years ago, my father was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer.
Oh, dear.
And he passed away 6 months later. And we were baffled. We didn't know where this came from. He worked all his life. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. Always worked and came home, went to church. That was Dad. And then, 3 years ago, 2009, this fall, my husband was diagnosed with leukemia. We had no clue where this came from. Because he was showing signs of it during the summer, and we didn't know what it was. And then 2 days later, after he was diagnosed, he passed away. Now my sister-in-law, my brother,